Hello, listener of the Third Sector podcast. This is Lucinda, and you're about to listen to the final episode of The End of Charity, our six-part documentary exploring the future for doing good. I hope you enjoy it.
So you have contracts coming to an end. We have less money. We have council saying, no, we won't fund you. We can't fund you. It's a cut here and a cut there until eventually your cloth is cut so small you can't continue.
What we want to do is create a space for a different kind of resourcing system to be imagined and tested and enacted. So while the immediate risks of reductions in funding in the short term feel real, we're also hoping that in time, the possibility of healthier resourcing systems feel equally real.
If the charity isn't there, who steps in? And there was a big empty silence on that. Nobody can step in.
You're listening to The End of Charity. I'm Lucinda Rouse. This is the final episode of our series exploring whether the traditional model of charity has had its day. So today we ask, what is a world without charity?
We are now approaching King's Lynn, our final destination. Please ensure that you take all your personal belongings with you when leaving the train.
Just before Easter, I travelled to King's Lynn in Norfolk to some near-empty offices. Until very recently, they were the headquarters of the charity West Norfolk Carers.
Hiya!
Hello.
I think you're looking for us.
Yes, West Norfolk Carers.
Yeah, come in. It's a bit empty and chaotic. It's very strange.
I was on a mission to meet the charity's chief executive, Jane Evans. She and her small team had auctioned off their furniture the week before, and I found them in the final stages of boxing up their remaining belongings, ready to move out.
The charity, just before Christmas, had to push the stop button. We were in danger of running out of funding and beyond March working illegally, in that we wouldn't have been able to meet the commitments to redundancy and winding up the costs of the charity. So the board took the really unhappy decision to close.
After more than 20 years supporting thousands of unpaid carers, who range in age from children as young as six to people in their late 90s, West Norfolk Carers had found itself a victim of an increasingly scarce funding environment.
When I first started working at West Norfolk Carers, the funding came from a single service level agreement with the local authority and another much smaller one with health. Over the years, that those SLAs have been eroded and devalued, and reliance on grants, on charitable giving has increased, so that I would say since 2016, we have relied solely on donations, on the National Lottery, on other grant-giving bodies to maintain the charity. It's not, in the great scheme of things, an expensive charity to run. It costs about £260,000 a year. So on that, you can see that not huge amounts of money are being spent on salaries. What we want to do is divert the funding to where it's needed, at the front line, where people need the support. And we've been very successful in achieving that until recently.
The dire situation the charity found itself in wasn't down to a lack of effort on the part of Jane and her colleagues.
During the last 12 months, I haven't sat there and thought, oh, all this money's going to run out, so we'll close. I have been working so hard, completing funding applications and grant applications. And whereas at one time I could have completed an application with relative confidence that it would be successful, that definitely hasn't been the case. And I've seen so many funding applications declined, and feedback from different agencies saying there was nothing wrong with your application. We just had too many applicants and we haven't got enough funding to meet the need, the demand. And it seems to me in the conversations that I'm having with different people, different organizations, that's a very widespread element. You know, so many people are losing statutory contracts, local authorities are reducing the amount that they spend, and grant giving bodies are also seeing a decline in donations. We as a charity also saw a decline in donations, charitable giving direct to us. So we were really caught up in a perfect storm and there was no way out of it. And I think when our last funding application was declined, which would have been in about November, our finance officers, you know, said we actually cannot go beyond March now.
Over the course of this series, we've heard from a lot of people about the possible alternatives to charity, models that are perhaps more agile or modern than those the sector currently offers. But before we think about the big picture today, let's take a minute to consider the individual consequences of a charity like West Norfolk Carers going under.
Niamh was 7 years old when she first joined Young Carers. That's been about 7.5 years ago that she first went. And the activities that they've done throughout the years, they've gone to Harry Potter World, they've done theme parks, all different things, including trips to the theatre, things that they wouldn't normally be able to go and do with other kids and just enjoy themselves.
This is Steve O'Donnell. His 14-year-old daughter, Niamh, is part of the Young Carers programme run by West Norfolk Carers. As well as organising activities, it provides one-on-one counselling support for young people with caring responsibilities.
My wife has hemiplegic cerebral palsy, which affects down the left side of her body and the right side of her brain, so she can't use her left arm. Mobility's weak at times, and it also affects her memory and stress. And it gives that bit of respite each month for my daughter to go out, do activities, and be with other children the same, and not have to feel that she is a young carer. That time is vital for her.
I asked Steve for his reaction when he heard that West Norfolk Carers was set to close.
It made me feel angry. Not for anything that West Norfolk Carers had done, because they have been brilliant throughout the years with everybody that's come through their doors. It's about the way the funding was just suddenly switched off and transferred elsewhere, thinking that they can save some money. But what they don't realise, it then actually costs them more, because if carers get forgotten, the disabled people then suffer. Because what happens when that carer ends up having a breakdown of some kind, or they just find they can't cope anymore, it then means the council have got to pay more, because they've then got to find other care services. So they're not going to end up saving any money, and it's kids' lives that they don't know the knock-on effect.
So when we found out that the charity was not going to be able to continue, it was heartbreaking, because we've all given so much to maintaining the charity, to supporting the people that come to us, and you look at them and you feel that you're letting them down. And now I have had one person that we supported shout at me, "Why did you let this happen?" And it made me feel terrible that they thought that I had just sat there and let all this stuff happen within the organisation and let it go easily, because that's very far from the case.
Listening to Jane talk really brought back to me the heart of why people work in charity and set up organisations like West Norfolk Carers. She is just one part of a vast network of people who, in their own small ways, are trying to make the world a better place, and you can hear the toll it takes when their efforts begin to fail. Although she felt very alone as she steered through these desperate few months, Jane's story is by no means an isolated one. At Third Sector, charity closure stories are coming in thick and fast. Among the many to have closed their doors since September 2023 are Children England, the Cares Family, the House of St Barnabas, and the British Youth Council. Fortunately, a new door has opened for West Norfolk carers, saving it from closure, at least for now. At the 11th hour, the charity was offered a new contract with the NHS to provide support when patients with caring needs are discharged from hospital. Jane and her team have secured 12 months of funding for this work and hope their contract will be renewed. The Young Carers Programme, which supports Steve and his daughter, is also continuing, thanks to a separate pot of funding. But how about the charities that haven't been so lucky? And what would happen to society if charities packed up for good? Here's our resident philanthropy expert, Rodri Davis.
If the charity sector disappeared tomorrow, the immediate short-term impact would be absolutely catastrophic on lots of people's lives, because there are so many people out there who rely on charities to get by and to help them kind of address their needs. Even if you believe that the end goal of most charity should be to make itself redundant because you've kind of solved the problem so there's no longer the need, the reality is we're not anywhere near that in most cases. So, you know, that's maybe an ambition to have, but if we got rid of charities tomorrow, that's far too soon.
For Rodri, the road ahead is long. There's no quick fix. But alongside organisations that are being forced to close out of financial necessity or circumstance, there are also charities that are deciding to get rid of themselves, if not tomorrow, then in the next few years.
And so by the time we got to the point of saying our organisation is part of the system that needs to change, there was almost a fait accompli where all of these factors had accumulated and made the final decision, which was to dissolve the organisation in pursuit of something different, almost inevitable.
This is Julian Corner, Chief Executive of the Lankelly Chase Foundation, a grantmaker focused on tackling severe social disadvantage and extreme marginalisation. The foundation made waves in the UK philanthropy world last summer when it announced that it would close itself down and redistribute its £134 million endowment within the next 5 years. I asked Julian to explain the reasons for bowing out at a time when many charities are scrabbling to find enough funding to remain open.
We are investing our wealth in global capitalism. So we are enmeshed in the very problem that we are trying to solve. We are part of it. And so we got to the point of asking ourselves, can something that is a direct function, a direct product of the system that it's trying to change, be a useful agent of change within that system? Can you be the thing while trying to change the thing simultaneously? And we concluded that no, the contradiction is too great.
As Jane struggles to meet the immediate needs of unpaid carers, Julian is taking a longer-term view, looking at the structures and systems that have led to the very inequalities Lankelly Chase is trying to overcome. Through much introspection and discussion with the groups it supports, the foundation reached the conclusion that its very existence was contributing to the myriad crises that are causing most harm to the world's most marginalised people, from climate change to human rights abuses. Announcing its decision to close last summer, the organisation said, "We view the traditional philanthropy model as so entangled with colonial capitalism that it inevitably continues the harms of the past into the present." There's been considerable praise for the foundation's bold decision within philanthropic circles, but Julian concedes that not all of its funding recipients are convinced by the news of its forthcoming closure.
Inevitably, there are others who are very wary of this decision and see it as posing a lot of risks, because we've been one of their reliable sources of income. We have to demonstrate through our work that the risk that we're taking in closing down this model is worth it because it's creating the possibility of something much more powerful and compelling and contextually relevant to the work that they are all doing. Because most of the organizations that we work with are dealing with the direct symptoms of extractive capitalism, of climate change, of an erosion of human rights. And yet they've also been struggling within a funding and resourcing system which struggles to get money to organizations like theirs. We have committed to ensuring that this decision doesn't create immediate crises for those whose work we've been supporting to date. And so over the next financial year, we're going to be looking very closely at the organizations we currently support and ensuring that there aren't cliff edges, that there isn't a rug pulled from under people. But I would stress, you know, that most foundations spend their time saying no to applications rather than yes. That the people who are on the books of foundations being funded is a fraction of the demand for funding out here. So although we have a responsibility to those who we currently fund, and we've chosen those people and those organizations for very good reasons, because we hugely value their work and want to see that work flourish, we're equally conscious that this is a system that has winners and losers, and actually many more losers than winners through it. And we also have always felt a huge responsibility to all those that we don't fund, that this system creates a lot of collateral damage in order to get money to a minority.
How do you respond to criticism that now is a really tough time for charities in terms of the funding landscape, and maybe people who feel that this really isn't the time to be addressing such structural inequalities and overhauling the system when so many organizations are hand to mouth and they need all the funds they can get?
I'm not going to downplay the risks of funders reimagining their role or even dissolving their role in favor of an alternative. Of course, there are risks there. And of course, we need to act with considerable care and responsibility and ensure that those who have relied on support from us to date are not left with cliff edges. However, I'd say a couple of things. One is, if not now, then when, in terms of reimagining the funding landscape. We've got a funding landscape which has been under huge critique for the last 2 to 3 years in terms of how power works, where the money comes from, how it's earned, how decisions are made. And that's only going to get more acute. And, you know, we need to get resources to those who are themselves trying to build alternatives to the current system. We need to get resources to those people as soon as possible, at a scale that is contextually relevant, because if we start to think about that in 5 to 10 years' time, when maybe things have eased off a little for the charity sector, it might be too late. If we carry on as we are, that itself is going to be creating its own risk, that in another 5 to 10 years' time, the iniquities and the issues for our planet and for our communities are only going to be starker and more acute.
I asked what form the alternatives to Llankelly Chase might take. Julian explained to me why he's unable to answer that at the moment.
We're not coming at this with a kind of, oh, we found the answer. We haven't got a kind of blueprint for what the future needs to look like, which is why we need to do the work with people who, to date, whose work has been under-resourced, but who are trying to model alternatives. The reason why I'm unable to point to alternatives is because those alternatives have never been resourced or taken seriously, because they challenge the business as usual norms of the capitalist system that we're in. What we know is that we want to create a space for radical difference to be imagined and tested. We're going to do this through a number of controlled experiments. And what this looks like in real terms is that we will be working with those whose work has been dedicated to imagining and enacting post-capitalist futures in their everyday working communities. we're going to be experimenting with how to shift decision-making power to those people while working with them.
So radical difference should be at the core of a post-funding future, at least as far as Julian's concerned. But should any aspects of the charitable model be taken forward as a way for Lankelly Chase and others to do good in today's society? The answer to that is no, according to Eshi Kiyamazuri, who you may remember from our exploration of mutual aid in episode 3.
I think the model is too unfit for purpose. I'm not a strong believer in reform, and I think that, you know, some other people may argue with that, and, you know, that's their decisions. But I think that when we spend time trying to reform a structure which inherently was set up to be oppressive, you know, it is built within that structure, then we are going to be fighting forever. Because how do we simultaneously keep working in that area while supposedly trying to reform it? It's not balancing out. It's fighting each other. If the idea of keeping working is not working with the idea of, you know, changing the structure, then we need to stop.
Perhaps, as Eshi suggests, those charities that are working now to evolve their practices to become more agile, equitable, and effective organisations are fighting a losing battle. But would the end of charity mean an end to doing good? And if not, where do those organisations fit in our society? Here's Rodri.
I've got faith in human beings and the idea that essentially we all kind of, most people are good people and we want to, you know, we care about each other and want to help as individuals and also to kind of, you know, address problems in society. And as long as charities exist as part of a landscape that allows people to do something about that, they'll be relevant and important. I guess I do think it's a moment at which the question of what is the unique value of charities and the charity model and charitable giving feels quite important, because there are all of these other options increasingly available. So I think in any sense that we could assume that people would look to charities because that was the only option available to them no longer holds true. I think there are arguments for why the idea of, you know, a legal structure for charities as organizations, or the idea of charitable giving as opposed to ethical shopping or investment, is important. But I think we need to be much clearer about what that importance is and make a really positive case for it, rather than just assuming that everybody gets it.
What does the anti-racism consultant Martha Awajobi think the future might hold?
I have hope that things will change. Like, I'm not saying that we're utterly doomed, but I think, you know, this is talking about the end of charity. Charities as we know it, the kind of formation of the professional charity, needs to completely change. And for me, it's thinking about how do charities reposition themselves to become accountable to the right people. And when we look about how change has been won in the past, it's not really by these like white leaders setting the direction. It is by people coming together, building power and demanding change and making it so that these organisations have to act.
Martha's view rings true with Julian's sense of what needs to change and how he sees the dissolution of his organisation contributing to that effort.
I think the thing that makes me feel most optimistic about the future of the charity sector is that it is made up of people who are deeply committed to human value and to the value of human flourishing, and who are pursuing this day in, day out. And then we're facing the most unprecedented challenge as a human race. And here we've got a whole world of people who are committed to the well-being of fellow humans. That's my point of optimism and hope. The question then is, what are the conditions that allow those people to do their best work?
For the vast majority of charities, the most urgent priority will be continuing to support the people they exist to serve. As we've discussed across this series, the need that charities are facing is escalating every day, and in the short term, there is very little that can ease this demand. Much as charities like the Trussell Trust would seek to dismantle at the first opportunity, It's clear that the closure of food banks tomorrow would mean removing a lifeline for those already in desperate need. So perhaps Rodri is right that while charities work towards closure in the long term, in the short term, one of the most important things they can do is tell the story of why they are so important here and now. And in a world where innovative new models of giving and doing good are on the rise, there's also a clear case to be made for the advantages of charity.
As more giving's shifting online, one of the most interesting trends to me, I think, has been the way in which that has led to, I often think of it as a sort of platformization of giving. So increasingly people are giving through platforms rather than directly to organizations. Initially, I think that was kind of through charity-specific platforms, but increasingly it's sort of through platforms that go broader, so crowdfunding platforms, and even sort of entirely non-charitable platforms. So there's a huge rise in the US, for instance, in people just giving via direct cash apps, so Cash App or Venmo. And the interesting thing is when that happens, you start to see much less focus on traditional organizations. People tend to give to unregistered groups or even just to individuals. So there's a sense in which technology is kind of bringing us full circle back to very old models of giving that are essentially about individuals appealing to other individuals and giving to them. And maybe that's good in one sense, in that, you know, it brings back that human connection. It might result in people giving more. I think there's going to be some challenges as well. It will reintroduce some of those individual biases that we've worked quite hard over a long, long period of time to try and smooth out. That's one of the reasons that we invented charities in the first place, was to find a way of getting resources from where people wanted to give them to where the need was genuinely greatest, rather than just relying on individuals to kind of make those decisions for themselves. And I think as we disintermediate potentially and sort of see some of those boundaries get more blurry, that's going to get more difficult.
And how about others working on the front lines of the existing charitable system? Do they see any cause for optimism in the charity space? Jane Evans at West Norfolk Carers.
I would love to be able to say yes, but the answer is no. I feel very concerned, very anxious that the situation that we were in a few months ago isn't improving. People come forward and say, we're going to close next year if we don't get funding. And you see then that it's actually not just you that's in that position. And that doesn't give me any joy, because all those charities, all those organisations are as important as the next one. And without those services, other people, vulnerable people, fall through the net, fall through the gaps. And once they've fallen through the gaps, I think it's really hard to find them again. If there wasn't this charity or us like us here, I just think the levels of poverty that we see within in the people that we support would be greater, because in amongst all the stuff that we're doing, we're finding grants, income, and in some cases, buying beds for people, because we've got children sleeping on their coats on the floor. In the 21st century, it's like something out of Little Dorrit sometimes. So I do feel concerned that without organisations like ours and the people that we work with, there would be far more community distress, if that's the, for want of a better word.
There is one thing most people seem able to agree on. The basic human instinct to help is never going to go away, regardless of the conditions in which we find ourselves or the structures for doing good that we decide to pursue. From the very public displays of generosity by Mr. Beast to the unsung community heroes on the end of the phone for their vulnerable neighbours. So whatever the future has in store, for the world of charity and beyond, one thing we can be certain about is this: the innate desire of most people to make the world a better place will be threaded through its landscape.
Even in an ideal world, if we had a much fairer society and it was much more equal and we'd address lots of these problems, would that mean we no longer needed charities? I don't know that it would. I think firstly because people are always going to have that basic desire and drive to help others, so they're always going to want an outlet for that, even where, you know, the government or the private sector is providing for all kinds of different needs. And there are also lots of things that charities do that are not just about poverty or basic need. They're about all kinds of other things, like, you know, the preservation of natural heritage or people getting involved in community gardens, for instance. And I don't see those getting replaced by the state or the private sector. And I wouldn't want to, because I think that would be a really unhealthy thing to happen. So I think the charity sector might evolve and end up doing different things as it has in the past. But I think it needs to continue to exist because it represents something fundamentally important about who we are as humans.
The End of Charity is brought to you by Third Sector, the UK's leading title for the voluntary and not-for-profit sector. It was written and presented by me, Lucinda Rouse, and edited by Emily Burt. The producer was Ollie Peart at Rethink Audio. And special thanks to Rebecca Cooney, who devised the original concept for the series. A lot of people were involved in the making of this series. We'd like to thank the following at Haymarket Media Group: Andy Ricketts, Till Owen, Nav Powell, Inga Marsden, David Robinson, Julian Dodd, Rachel Jordan Cook, Emily Hall, and Dami Adewale. And at Rethink Audio, Louise Hill, Riham Maged, Penny Bell, and Matt Hill. We hope you've enjoyed listening to The End of Charity. And if you have, there are three simple ways that you could support us. Firstly, you could spread the word to others who might be interested but haven't found us yet. And if you'd like to go the extra mile, leaving a positive rating or review on the podcast platform you use would really help us. We'd love to hear your feedback on this series. Thank you for listening.